Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined by myself because we're solo podcasting. We're going to meander around today. I have a few things I want to touch on, specifically the 5-1 human design slash gene keys profile, a specific aspect of it that I've been experiencing on overdrive lately. We're gonna delve into fragmentation and ultimately land on wrong use of will, which I believe we spoke about in my last solo podcast. And because there are just so many different ways that these hierarchical languaging patterns express, we're gonna stick with it. And broaden our understanding. It's really up right now with our ridiculous fake election theatrics or candidacy, like whatever is happening in the political theater realm. There's all this hullabaloo around a specific candidate. I don't even want to use her name because it's all feeling so toxic. I'm really not feeling like articulating or aspirating the sham show frequencies of that particular op through my own being in this moment. Or at the same time, it doesn't feel respectful of your sacred attention and consciousness. So we'll just say there is a candidate whose entire candidacy is being propped up on her vagina and the melanin that may or may not exist in her skin. It's just about sex and race. And as I said, we'll get into wrong use of will towards the end of today's show. And it is so wrong use of will to ghettoize women and Black people and to allege that they need to be thrown bones to succeed, right? We're not talking about her policy. We're not talking about her past, her vision beyond, you know, these newly inserted kind of like over the top Marxist social bits that she's pointing to. I will just say, as a woman, I am not interested in anything being given to me or any branding around me being because I have 2X chromosomes. That is wrong use of will, because that is to disempower other people. That is to project a story that other groups of people are lower than the higher groups of people. And whether the story around it is that this needs to be corrected or whatnot, to keep throwing that story into the mix is to sustain that story, to disempower the people belonging to these groups upon whom these stories are being projected. It is to put them down. It is to say, you are deemed less than in this society. I'm not saying that we don't have issues of inequality, but to sustain these stories and project these stories and then invite other people to internalize these stories so that we can ourselves adopt some sort of victim less than attitude, that's all wrong use of will. But that's not really the point, but because it's up and I'm seeing it, it's just so lame and annoying. And I'm going to encourage you and me and all of us to not lob those stories on other people, regardless of what groups they might be identified with, either personally or collectively. Like, just don't, you know, I don't like it when people throw the like poor Jew, like whatever that is. I don't even know what that is, because I grew up in the San Fernando Valley where like Jews were the majority and also thriving, which I think Jews do. So why is there this like, there's so much effort going into like keeping alive the Holocaust sob story that happened so long ago as like a mean of like tethering Jews to victimhood, to this albatross of, oh, everyone should pity me, feel sorry for me, free speech platforms should, you know, prohibit questioning the Holocaust, denying the Holocaust. Why can't we deny the Holocaust? Like, why, like, is the Holocaust so fragile? That's what it makes me think. Like, oh, if we're not allowed, like, culturally, I mean, I don't know if those bounds are on speech as hate speech. I would imagine probably. But, like, doesn't it make us wonder, like, well, why is that story so fragile that it needs such protection? I wasn't questioning it before, but now that you're telling me I'm not allowed to question it, I'm gonna question it. And so what? Like, what? It's just so out of hand. Anyway, all of these things come under the umbrella of wrong use of will when we're lobbing these stories at other people. Oh, we need to vote for what's her butt because she's a woman. Oh, we need to vote for what's her butt because it's high time the United States has a vagina in the Oval. Like, okay, let's even pretend that these weren't retarded wrong use of will concepts that assume that women need these sorts of this type of like spin to get into the Oval Office. Like, I don't know anyone would want to be there anyway, given what that whole thing is, but like, how about we just vote for the most qualified person? I wish that was our default at all times. It just makes the most sense, and I'm sure at some point the most qualified person could be a woman, could be a Jew, could be an alien, could be a zebra, like whatever. But I'm gonna take a sip. That larger cultural narrative right now, I want to vote for the first black woman, whatever, with the state of our nation. At this moment, that is the worst possible voting strategy. It's not about the shallow virtue signaling optics of what it's going to look like to the rest of the world, of what we can brag about having voted for. Like, it's really not the right time to be playing that shiny, happy people fake game. I feel like our wisest move would be to vote for the most qualified person, the person with the clearest vision and the chops to take us there and an action plan to take us there. And you can decide whoever that is. I don't know that the choices are really going to be reflective of that or are reflective of that, but it just seems like of all the years to default to shallow virtue signaling optics, can it not be this one? That's all I'm saying. But anyway, that was just a tributary we took upon the mention of wrong use of will. Before we get into any of that, before, so many preambles, all in divine timing. I'm still reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. Okay, homework done. Housekeeping done. I want to just share something with you guys because it came up again and it's topical. And I'm not sure if I've shared this story before, but you know, I've been ejected pretty hardcore from the journalism community I was a part of when I was in Los Angeles, when I was writing for the LA Weekly, actually, even in Santa Fe, because I used to write for the Santa Fe Reporter, and now I've been banned for life. I've also been banned for life, the New Mexican. Why? What are my transgressions, you asked? Great question. My transgressions were for the reporter, it was calling the New Mexico Health Department and asking them how they were collecting their numbers as related to the COVID deaths and asking how many PCR cycles they were running. That got me banned from the Santa Fe Reporter. What got me banned from the New Mexican was after we had the election a year or two ago, and our governor was somehow reelected, which made no sense because even like my diehard Trump-hating liberal landlord voted against her. I called in asking for a forensic audit, and they said, "Oh, we did the audit. Everything's on the up and up." And I said, "Well, who certified the audit?" And the person on the phone says, the governor herself, who was just reelected, so it was her election that she chose to certify, her deputy, who was also being reelected, who was also certifying her own election, and their accountant. yay for justice. So I called the New Mexican and spoke with the editor in chief about this. And he laughed and told me I was a crazy conspiracy theorist and then hung up on me. So I have been ejected from established journalism. It's fine. It's not a problem. I don't really want a part of something that fetid and rotten and gross. But I'm still a human being. And it's still a process. And I go through this with my clients a lot lately, actually, where, like, sure, it's been 4 years, right? So it's been 4 years that we're used to being ejected from our friend group, our families, our jobs, our communities, right? Like 4 years of getting used to a certain sort of pariahhood. But it ebbs and flows. Like I was talking to someone about it last night, and it's like, I don't know that our hearts will ever heal from this fully. I mean, I don't want to limit anyone, but, and it's like, you know, I've gone through several phases of just giving away everything I had. And then years later, it's like something will come up that I hadn't thought about in a decade. And it's like, oh, fuck, I really miss that. You know, it's like that to an extent, only like way more painful. So I got pinged a little bit within my old LA Weekly journalist community because I saw a post on Facebook and I was actually shocked. I'm like, wow, this person hasn't blocked me. Like that's a good sign, maybe. But anyway, they were all, and it was all journalists, right? All journalists that I'd work with, all journalists who are the current gatekeepers of information, and at least in the print realm, these are the ones who are not only pushing out propaganda, but like, you know, discrediting things that they haven't researched as fake news, and teaching the new crop of journalism students. So it's so annoying. So it was a post about this presidential thing and, or this candidate who, I don't feel like uttering the word today. And how there are all these lies circulating about her history with Willie Brown or her having slept her way to the top. And then it was just like going off on like demonizing the crazy, weird Republican conspiracy theorists for believing this. And this is a thread full of journalists, right? And that's where I get annoyed. It's like, okay, people want to be stupid and shove their heads in the sand and end, you know, friendships and relationships over news that they can't even be bothered to research. Okay. But when it's journalists who are actually being paid to vet news and information and disseminate to the public, and they're not doing it, it's just a new level for me. And, you know, I use this whole giant, excruciating FOVID PSYOP, and all the ensuing PSYOPs as a means of personal development, right? Like, what else do we do with it? Like, okay, let me take this pain. Let me take these expectations, this hurt, whatever. Mind them for the lessons, integrate, become more and more whole, all of those things. So part of that, pause for a sip, I'm thirsty today. Part of that is learning not to judge, right? Look, I am still learning everything that I teach. I write the books that I write and I create the content that I create so that I can learn it for myself. So I claim no mastery minus the mastery in process that is indeed always happening. So a big piece was learning not to otherize and not to judge and like create, you know, tools and strategies so that when I see someone double masked and acting like a psycho in the produce aisle of the co-op in August of 2024, I don't leap to say or think something that would be dehumanizing. Also learning to hold differences of opinion the way we used to, like only 10 years ago, and it really didn't have to be a relationship killer or a reputation ruiner. And I'm still learning to do this with my former journalism friends and colleagues because I just don't have any respect for people who don't do their jobs well. It's like, fine, you want to throw away a 20-year friendship with me? Have at it. But you want to tell the world by way of the Los Angeles Times that some bull crap that you haven't researched is actually true? Now I have a problem with that. And I'm still learning to, like, it's a one-room schoolhouse. It is what it is. But we definitely have the inmates running the asylum here, and it's so frustrating to watch. So, I mean, I weighed in, it was just like, it's an established fact that this being's relationship, like, with Willie Brown is what had him get her put into positions for which she wasn't qualified. Like, this is established. And how about you look something up before jumping on the, like, pundit propaganda crazy train? Journalists. Ugh. Anyway, so what I wanted to share, because I just wanted to give us, I know some people here are newer to tracking my content, and I just want to give this pitch perfect example of who is not only giving you and me and all of us our news, but who is teaching our college students how to be journalists and how bad it really is out there. But first, I'm going to pause for another sip. I recently learned that ingesting methylene blue at the same time as doing red light therapy is like the magic secret sauce, because the methylene blue goes directly to the injured area, and I don't know what it's doing. I'm not going to pretend to be a biologist, let alone an evolutionary biologist like Brett Weinstein, which is code for I know everything. I am not that, but I will tell you, because I have my red light therapy wrap on now. It's been a total game changer in terms of optimizing the bod. So that's what's happening now. All right. So what I wanted to share was a little story from the archives. So I was just coming off of having finished writing Plandemic 2 with Mickey. It was, you know, a swell of emotions, a lot of pride, a lot of exhaustion. The censorship was just starting to pour in. I don't think we realized yet that, like, it just was going to be squelched to the extent that it was squelched. But anyway, so I get a text from my former editor, with whom I haven't spoken in, I'd say, a good 6 months. There were no words. The text just said, it was a link to a New York Times article, and it said, here's why you shouldn't watch Plandemic 2 Indoctrination. Now, the person who sent it to me had no idea that I had just written this very documentary. So it was a really odd situation. But I played stupid, and I texted back and I said, have you seen this documentary yet? And he said, no, I wouldn't waste my time watching it. Now, this was something that I'd heard from, like, I remember going to the Beck concert with a friend of mine, and I mentioned something about Alex Jones, and he was like disgusted. And I said, and he was like, oh, he's trash, he's this, that. And I said, have you ever watched Alex Jones? No, I wouldn't waste my attention. And it's like, okay, but if you feel that way, then you don't really have an opinion, because you don't have anything to go on. So how about just shutting up? Like, it doesn't. Or if you want to stick to that opinion, how about you delve in and you explore? But again, there's a difference between regular humans, between regular humans deciding to shove their heads in the sand and drum up indoctrinated opinions based on no research whatsoever. But it's another thing when it's a journalist. It's another thing when it's a journalist who's going out of his way to tell other people to not look at this thing. It's like spreading the censorship. I call it a virus, but it's, we'll say pathogen, because I don't want to argue about whether or not it really exists, even though we haven't isolated it. But it's like doing the bidding of your oppressors, but you're not even going to, like, look into, I mean, of course they're not. Anyway, so he texts back, no, I wouldn't waste my attention on anything so trashy, or something like that. I still have not revealed that I wrote it. And I said, I find it weird that as a journalist, you're sending me a message to not watch something that you yourself haven't watched to vet it yourself, Plus, as a journalist, like, aren't you kind of offended that the New York Times is telling us what to watch or not watch? I didn't hear a response at that point. That's actually the last time we connected. But this is a person who not only is writing for mainstream news, but is also teaching about journalism, new media, and propaganda at a college in Los Angeles. And I did actually reach out to this person last year because I still get bugs up my ass about this. It's so annoying to me with like my journalism mentors. I'm still in the process of resolving it. Anyway, I said, hey, when I saw that he was teaching a propaganda course at a college in Los Angeles, and he was using my movie as part of his curriculum, but I know for a fact he hasn't watched my movie. I said, hey, it would be great to have you on the podcast, and let's just have an intelligent discourse about censorship as two journalists. And he was like, no, thank you. So notice that, like, this is the other thing that I've noticed is like there's no availability for discourse around it, but these are the people who are driving the conversation, who are training the new generation of journalists, who are alleging to have like the integrity, ethics, and authority to report on news for the rest of the country. It is offensive to the bone, people. And the last piece that I want to share is that, so he and I were both writing for The Weekly back in 2008. And back in 2008, I was sending him link after link after link to articles and videos about the Obama scam. Because I've always been this way. It's not like I turned. Like, I was, so many people are like, well, you used to be a liberal Democrat, right? And I'm like, no, I was a libertarian. Since I got my panties in a bunch about saying the Pledge of Allegiance in first grade when I thought there was supposed to be a separation between church and state and we had to say under God. So, no, I've always been this way. And I was always what, you know, when I was at the Weekly, they call me their nutter butter writer because the word conspiracy theorist wasn't quite as in vogue, right? It certainly was in vogue around the Warren Commission time. And then it fell out, and we were just like kooky nutter butters. So back then, before that election, I was sending him a ton of stuff, and he was like, "You're crazy. You're a nutter butter," and he wouldn't look at any of it. But he was not only reporting on politics for all of Los Angeles, but also editing other journalist pieces. And I was like, "Look, you are shaping the information you're putting out is shaping the consciousness and the perspective of a city of over 3 million people. You have a duty as a journalist to look at everything. If you read these articles that I'm sending you and you decide after reading them and vetting the research and the sources in them and you decide it doesn't resonate, great, perfect, respect. But as a journalist and as an editor of, you know, an extremely widely circulated paper, I think you have a duty to at least check this out. Not to mention the fact that like I'm your friend and I'm one of your writers, and you have respect for me as a smart person. So, what about opening your mind to the possibility that what I'm sending you has some sort of value or validity, right? It's so weird to me, like seeing how many people, you know, who I've since been ejected from their lives, but like back in the day, they valued my opinion. They thought that I was smart. They would seek out counsel. They would come to me to understand larger issues. But then with this one, we know what happened. Anyway, I'm obviously still processing this hurt. And I just thought to share that with you. And just the ridiculousness of like everyone on this thread that I was reading going off on how this being who less than a month ago was the joke of her own party, who knew how useless she was. And now, because the mind control narrative has flipped, they're all in, and these are the people. It's like the chicken and the egg, right? They're the one falling for the mind control, and then they put out more mind control, and okay. I really look forward to the swift restoration of freedom of speech in this country. I feel it. It's coming any second, guys. What's next? Next was, all right, we'll do a little one on fragmentation because I believe that I mentioned fragmentation in in the last solo podcast. So fragmentation, as I mentioned, it's another tool of the social engineers, right? It's like creating little it's like when there's a crack in the sidewalk, right? If you're a little kid and you're on, you know, those old school crappy roller skates, you're looking for as much smooth surface as possible. But there's a crack in the sidewalk, or it's, you know, the space between the squares, and it disrupts your flow. Perfect example of fragmentation, right? And as we talked about, like, momentum is key to getting into flow states, which is why we're seeing so much interruption, confusion, and fragmentation being deployed on the populace at large to keep us from gaining momentum in so many areas. You know, I just recently did an interview with Robert Phoenix. And the reason that I had Robert Phoenix on was because I heard him mention all these tech companies, specifically Zoom, all implementing operating system uptypes that change the interface in dramatic inverted ways all at the same time. And I was so excited to have him on because this is something, obviously, if you're listening to me, you know I talk about a lot, social engineering through the tech space and the weaponization of customer service. So we were talking about it, and how it just creates these bumps. So it's like you can't That momentum that we thrive on, it just creates these like roadblocks and, you know, needle record skips and like So the latest instance I saw of fragmentation, and trust me, I'm seeing it all day, every day, just anything that disrupts the flow. But I went to a Santa Fe Institute talk, which Emily and I are going to discuss on Words 90. So we'll talk about that on our next Words podcast. And for those who are interested in tuning in, you can find that at wordspodcast.locals.com. You can use the promo code Welcome to Words, all caps, for a free month of membership. And that gives you a chance to catch up on what we're doing there. As long as I'm doing my words podcast commercial break, Santa Fe Institute is something we've been covering for quite a long time. Again, I personally would love to put so much more attention on it. And because Words Podcast is a labor of love that definitely isn't paying any bills as of yet, it's just not the smartest use of my attention and bandwidth right now to be diving full force into that full time, even though, God, I would love that. And for anyone who wants to catch themselves up to speed on what the Santa Fe Institute PSYOP is all about, and keep in mind, it is kind of the mother of all PSYOPs. It's like one of the kind of bases from which so many PSYOPs are pouring out of, one of them being the whole Joe Rogan intellectual dark web. We started talking about that on episode 60. So if as you are going to take advantage of the free month membership with promo code Welcome to Words over there, I recommend you know, scrolling back a few pages and getting yourself to Words episode 60 to get an understanding of what this PSYOP is about. Words 59 is kind of like a precursor to that one. I believe we go into Daniel Schmachtenberger, who's part of Santa Fe Institute, in that one. So if you're really nerding out on it, go back to 59. But if you just want the basics of like what the Santa Fe Institute PSYOP is all about, Words episode 60 has got your back. Okay, so this talk was about it was about the economy and like economic predictions and like how to manipulate the economy by manipulating stupid people with propaganda. As I said, we're gonna go through this on the next episode of Words. It was so offensive for anyone with ears to hear. Anyway. So one of the hallmarks of their particular PSYOP, and it's really tied in with academia, is, well, I was going to say it's these citations, but I want to back up because apparently it's a nonlinear day. And the basic kindergarten crux of the intellectual dark web, Joe Rogan psyop that Emily and I have been covering most specifically is that in service to their one world government, techno-fascist communist agenda, but I think it goes even way further out in terms of like post-extinction off-planet stuff, but dialing it back, the basic kindergarten op is to get us to a place where we see that democracy is untenable because of the duopoly, because of the fixed two-party system, although the third-party candidate is also part of the exact same psyop and the exact same system. But at some point, they're going to put in this remedy, or their aim is to put in this remedy. I don't see them getting away with it, but it is to create an intellectual elite ruling class, which will absolutely include, Brett Weinstein, Eric Weinstein, Tristan Harris, insert similar fucktards. And they're the ones who will tell us like who's allowed to have free speech, what levels and layers of ontological reality we're allowed to research, who's going to be mandated with certain injections. They'll be the ones who will be running the whole totalitarian game under the auspices of their intellectual superiority. So, because that's again high-level kindergarten version of what they're aiming to achieve, what we see happening as the op runs itself is consistent and like deafening ways to establish intellectual superiority by way of like academia, and then they'll have other trusted leaders. And when I say trusted leaders, like they're certainly not trustworthy and they're not leaders in any real sense of the word, but in terms of like the propaganda technique that you can read about in Pop Propaganda, an illustrated guide, which features 37 illustrated propaganda techniques. So another way they do this is by having anyone who interviews Eric Weinstein, Brett Weinstein, Daniel Schmachtenberger, I'm trying to think who else gets the like alleged intellectual superiority points. I'm sure there are more, but they'll always have the interviewer commenting on how, any of these IDW douchebags are the smartest people in the world, right? So this is, they're just, remember the name of the propaganda game is repetition, repetition, repetition. So everything surrounding these people is they're intellectually superior, they're smarter than us, they're smarter than us. That's going on 24/7. So what I've noticed going to these Santa Fe Institute lectures is how much of their work is about them. Like it's so self-referential and narcissistic. And instead of like making it about here's the work and here are the ideas, it's like here's this idea that I'm the one who created. I'm the one who coined this phrase. I'm the one who, got the Nobel Prize for talking about this. Like whatever. It's always, right? And what is that a sign of? I'm having no real internal authority, no real self-esteem, right? It's a sign of like super shaky self-esteem, but these are the people who are being propped up as supposed leaders, but they're constantly referencing themselves like the way rappers do, right? That and that's such a Tavistock psyop in and of itself, right? To have that kind of like self-referential insecurity being programmed through all of like current rap stuff. It's so lame. Let's pause for a sip on that. But what I notice in this particular lecture is in all the slides, he would list like multiple names who I guess he was crediting for the ideas that were featured on the slide. And in a couple instances, there would be like, someone's picture on a slide, and all they're all young, like really young, like brains still developing young. And this will, as I said, this will understanding why that's so will come through Words 90, which is on its way. But it was so fragmenting. And when the guy was giving his talk, which was all about, it doesn't even matter, but it's definitely tied into like MIT. MIT is the one who gave us the whole computer modeling sham, right? all came from like the limits to growth, the eugenics thing, where they're projecting these computer numbers of like the resource scarcity and like how untenable human life on the planet will be in these times because of what they're calling overpopulation, right? So all that was created to prop up population control, but then, I mean, it's still being used to prop up population control, and we see it being deployed in like the FOVID op, right? All those numbers, those are computer projections. They weren't real numbers. I mean, there were the fake numbers that came from like, we know all of that. I don't even need to go into it. But one of their weapons is these computer models. So he was talking about using his computer models for economic forecasts, for COVID, for climate fraud, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what the talk was about. But every idea purported had to be credited to someone else. And like to a certain extent, yeah, it's nice to give people credit for their work and their words. But in this instance, it was so fragmenting. He would say a sentence and then he would like cite, you know, who had that idea. And it's like, I don't care. Like, keep us moving forward. This is a huge tool of academia, which is a huge tool of hierarchy, which is a huge tool of you know, ideological subversion. And I'm not linking ideological subversion to hierarchy, but I'm just showing us how this weapon that is fragmentation is functioning in multiple ops, right? Obviously, we see it in the alphabet op with the they, right? Super fragmenting. What? Who are we talking about? Oh, who, you know, it's like that. So same with this guy, where it's like, can you just talk about your ideas instead of stopping every 5 minutes to point us to some other person? Like, we're not tracking. It's not a kind, polite way to have a conversation. And we see this a lot in academia in terms of like citing their ideas, which to me, and I'm only, you know, and I guess I realized this back when I was in college, where it's like original thinking, independent thinking are not rewarded in those environments. Maybe to a certain extent, some independent thinking is in technological advancement, but I think it's got to be all within the same construct and paradigm. But because original thinking is not, it's not encouraged and it's not rewarded, then they create this inverse system, right? So they're like inverting true, I don't want to say intellectual intellect. I mean, it's just being smart. So they're inverting the idea of being smart to being able to take other people's ideas and regurgitate them. I would hope there's an like a realm of transfer that's and like building upon, but I did notice this when I was in school. And I noticed this with a book that I, it doesn't even matter. But I did notice this when I wrote a cover story for the LA Weekly that got a lot of attention, right? And Hollywood wanted to do a movie and they wanted to do a TV show and FSG wanted me to do a book. And when I wrote the book, it was like, well, where are you getting these ideas? Like, you can't put these ideas out unless you can cite where they came from. And I'm like, well, they came from me. Like, I put pieces together and I was just told like, no, you don't have enough letters after your name to do that. So in this realm of like inverted intelligence, which is all about following and definitely about like staying within the established boundaries and not venturing off, you know, don't color outside the lines, don't go off the trail. This is a way of signaling their false authority and their false intellect is people who, when they're speaking, they'll pause to like reference the book where they got this from. You know what? Great example of this is my super boring interview with Mark Gaffney. I think the second interview was more interesting because that's when I called him on his bullshit. But the first one, I mean, he does it in both because it's his go-to strategy, which is like, well, I'm gonna keep citing all these other books and all these other authors and pummel you with references which have been conflated through propaganda to be associated with intellectual prowess, when they're not. But so you'll notice this is like super hallmark in the academic world. And it was so annoying in this SFI talk. And I was just thinking, like, it's so fragmenting that he keeps leaving the point, which obviously I think it's clear when someone's doing that, they're not even connected with their point. Like, they're not really dropped in. Like, basically, he's not buying his own bullshit if he keeps pulling himself out of it to tell us why we should believe his bullshit. It's such an obvious strategy. So start to notice this, you know, with these like phony intellectual douchebags. Next up is, I want to speak to the experience of being a 5-1 manifesting generator. So fair warning, deep woo trigger report. I don't know if human design and gene keys are considered deep woo, but I am going to be talking about human design and gene keys, I guess, because cosmic blueprint mapping systems, because last week was like a 5-1 doozy for me. So there are these delineations, and I'm certainly no expert in human design by any means, but you know, in gene keys and human design, there's a lot of crossover, right? Richard Rudd, who created the gene keys, was a student of Ra and of human design. And a lot of that informs the gene keys. So in both systems, there are two numbers that are considered our design. They're like code for our design. So some people are going to be like a 4-1 or a 1-3. And if you're interested, you can look these up, you know, on the Gene Keys site or on the Human Design site. Yes, I do Gene Keys readings. So if you're interested in learning more about your own Gene Keys profile, do reach out to me. But what we're talking about today is the 5-1 profile. So 5-1 is considered the most transpersonal of the signs, right? Where so those who are, you know what, I pulled something up on this. So maybe instead of me winging it, I'm just going to read it to you. Five ones live these very transpersonal lives, right? So here it says, this is from Juliet Stapleton's website, 5-1 and 5-2 profiles are called transpersonal, as they are here not for their own personal journeys, like most other profiles. Line 5 is here to condition the other, to impact the other. So, you know, what I always say to people who have the 5-1 line, it's like, we're feeling things so deeply because we're feeling for the collective, because we're being invited to transmute for the collective. So everything we're doing is really in service to the collective. But the other thing with the 5-1 profile is we're the most projected upon. So a few things happen, and I just want to give us this as, so we can just have this lens through which to receive my own personal experiences of this. Okay. So this woman says, of all the lines, the most mystical to me is line 5, right? So when we say we have a 5-1 profile, the 5 modifies, I'll just speak for the gene keys, right? So the 5 would be the line number that modifies our life's work sphere and our evolution sphere. And then the 1, the number that comes after the slash in the 5-1 profile, that's going to be the line number that modifies the radiant sphere and the purpose sphere in the gene keys profile. Again, as I said, if all that sounds like gobbledygook, but you're curious about it, reach out to me and I'll break it down for you. The 5 line is a very different line, and people with a lot of line 5 energy in their profile, and if they have a lot of line 5 in other areas of their design, have a true potential to save the world with their unique and often against the grain vision. But most of the time, only strangers see that amazing energy. And while they pick on its seductive magnetic leadership pull, they start projecting their own assumptions and expectations on that line 5. And this is where the tricky part is. People with line five live in projections of others and polarizing ones. The closer people know them, they seem to be more likely to project their own issues, expectations, and visions onto the line five. So this is what we're talking about today because, oh my God, you guys, the projections last week were so crazy. And I will say, this is where both the Gene Keys and Human Design have been so helpful in my life, is helping me understand that, like, I'm never going to resolve being projected upon. It's part of my design. This leads in perfectly to wrong use of will, because people just projecting their unintegrated stuff onto me. It's so crazy. Anyone who's a 5-1, I'm really excited for you to weigh in, you know, and I'd love your feedback on this because it can be so freaking annoying. So I made an executive editing decision and I'm pausing our chronological flow because I decided to edit out a personal story that I ultimately didn't feel comfortable sharing. I am, however, about to reference that story. So all you need to know is there was a conversational exchange wherein apparently there was the silent expectation that I wouldn't say certain things. I didn't know this. I said the certain things, and then I was told that I did the conversation wrong. I think that's all you need to know. I can't promise to not reference back to it as the podcast unfolds, and you're smart, you're multidimensional, you'll totally figure it out. We got this. This was so nuts. Because it was just like I failed her expectations. Like, she had this idea in her mind of how the conversation was gonna go. It didn't go that way. Instead of being with her own, like, oh, that conversation didn't go the way I thought it would, and like handling it with her own grown-up tools, instead she went right to like, you did this, you did this, you did this. It was freaking fascinating. It was fascinating because it's like an experience that I've had, right? As someone who's animated by a 5-1 design, right? I'm not gonna conflate my identity with it. I'm not gonna victimize myself to that cosmic makeup. I am simply going to speak about my experience of moving through reality, being colored by that cosmic blueprint. Is when people put me on a pedestal and it's like, ooh, do not do that. I am not a pedestal worthy being. I don't think anyone's pedestal worthy because I don't believe in hierarchy, because hierarchy is outdated. So I'm the last person to put on a pedestal, A, because I don't believe in pedestals or pedestaling, and B, because I am so flawed, as we all are, and that pedestal will come crashing down so fast, because my humanity is like fast and furious. Like, it's marked by totality. Like, I am all of the things. And that means that if someone's gonna put me on a pedestal, there will come that moment where I destroy their expectations of me. And, you know, at this stage, I'm used to it. But I will say, you know, numerous occasions of seeing the look, that moment on someone's face where my inconvenient humanity inserts itself into the dynamic, and all of a sudden, all of their pedestal-like projections come crashing down like the Connect Four. And just, you know, it took me a while to get used to that look in their eye where it's like, oh, I've so disappointed them. I'm so not what they thought I was, what they projected onto me. So that was one of those instances. And we're going to come back to that because it was such a wrong use of will. The way she handled it was so wrong use of will. But the other one happened where, so when I put out, look, I'm not going to go through which podcasts are my favorite and which podcasts are not. I'll leave that to you to decide. And putting out podcasts every week the way I do, I don't think everyone's a slam dunk, right? And I'm being realistic for myself of understanding how creativity works and how, you know, being a quote unquote content creator works, which I guess is what I am now. I mean, I'd really prefer to be a journalist, but that doesn't seem to exist anymore. I've really embraced the idea of just messy action. Just get it done, right? I've definitely gotten stuck in procrastinating around like warped ideas of perfection, and I've learned for myself, maybe other people have a different strategy, it's better for me to just take messy action and get stuff done. So some podcasts I don't feel that great about, and I'm just putting them out and trusting that there's a morsel in there for someone. And that's, you know, that's really the main thing that I've learned, is get my ego out of the way. If I said something stupid, if I'm feeling dysregulated, if I'm having a bad hair day, like whatever it is, trusting that there's a method to the madness and that it's not all about me. And this has happened so many times. There's so much confirmation where I'll put out something that's like, I think the worst podcast I've ever done. And then I'll get feedback from multiple people that there was something I said that like unlocked something for them that was really helpful to them, right? I've had this thought in like awkward conversations with friends and colleagues that are like cringy and mortifying, that I wish never happened, you know, or I want to go back and like send an explanation or apology or something. And it's like, don't, like, just trust that maybe if that was something cringy for me, that person got something out of it that they needed for their journey. And it doesn't have to be about me all the time. And it's okay if I show up messy or spassy or awkward or like whatever it is. So that's been a practice for me with the podcasts. And I got some commentary on a podcast that I put out that was like, ugh, this again. Oh no, you need to stop doing this. You can't do this. Is horrible. This is a nightmare. And it was like multiple comments from the exact same person in multiple platforms where it was so over the top of like, I get it. You're not into this podcast. That's fine. But A, I don't need to hear about it. B, I don't need to hear about it 10 times in 10 different platforms. C, do not ever tell me what to do, how I should podcast, what I should be doing, what I should be talking about, what I shouldn't be talking about. No, no, that is wrong use of will. That is the core pathogen that has our populace so badly confused, thinking everyone has the right to tell other people what to say, what to think, what not to say, how to vote. All of that is wrong use of will. So everyone has a right to their opinion. But no one has a right to tell anyone else what they should or should not say and how they should or should not do their own thing. So in light of two instances, there were actually more, but I feel like we have enough of the lay of the land that I don't need to go into them. They're super boring. I cannot stand wrong use of will. But I want to unpack it a little bit deeper for us so that we can learn to stay in our own lanes and not feel the need to control or project our own discomforts and preferences and expectations onto other people, because all that does is sully our relationship space, inspire other people to armor up, create defenses, because no one likes to have others' will imposed upon them, right? That's what triggers lizard brain, amygdala, has us armoring up, has us moving into defense conflict mode. All that happens when we attempt to impose our will onto others, whether it's conscious or unconscious, it's an ineffective social strategy. It's super disrespectful to our fundamental agency and autonomy and inner authority as human beings. It's so freaking egregious and wrong. So I want us to learn this so we can all stop trampling on one another's God-given agency and inner authority and stop mucking up our human situation with wrong use of will. I'm gonna pause. I just got a little irritated. That does it for the first half of today's solo podcast. As you are inspired to check out the second half, you can find that along with all of my second half conversations, my post-show throwdowns, oodles of bonus content over on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to the last half of this and so many awesome inspired conversations, plus the knowledge that you're giving back, that you're supporting an outspoken word nerd in her content creation journey. And it helps me keep on keeping on. I'm also inviting you to sign up for my newsletter at dannycats.com and scope out my offerings there if you're inspired to learn more about me, dip into my courses, my webinars, if you're curious about what it's like to do coaching with me or bring me into your organization as a consultant. You can find all of those details at dannycats.com. In the meantime, thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Patreon and the Locals. Have a rockin' day.